So for some number of weeks and Wednesday evenings, I was giving a series of talks about the Buddha's awakening. It's kind of a big topic. And that the heart of his awakening was the recognition that there was not a separate solid self. And it's interesting that the Buddha did not actually start out with this. It's often a very central question in spiritual practice, which is the question, who am I? But that was not his question. His question, as he set out on his spiritual path, was really about understanding suffering and the end of suffering. And it turns out that as he walked his path, that the answer to understanding suffering and the end of suffering had everything to do with how we understand who we are, who we take ourselves to be. And really the heart of what he discovered is summed up in the Pali phrase, the understanding of pratikasamuppada, which is a teaching that it describes basically because of this, that arises. Because of that, the next thing arises, and so on. And the idea is, in a simple way, as wonderful, one of my early mentors, teachers, Buckminster Fuller, used to say, I seem to be a verb. And this is a shorthand for what the Buddha discovered, was that it's not that the teaching of what was later described as anatta, of non-self, didn't mean, one of my other old Zen teachers used to say, no self doesn't mean there's nobody home, right? So we all know, even if it's your first time ever sitting, that if you sit down and pay attention, there's quite a bit going on, isn't there? Right? So no self is not some big empty void that we're going to fall into. Really what it means, again, is that there's not a separate solid thing. What's happening is a process. What's happening is an aliveness. What's happening is constantly changing like that. And I've been using the metaphor for some time, which came spontaneously one Wednesday night, but I really like it a lot, which is this idea of the shift of our of understanding who we are from being an ice cube to being a river. And that a lot of our suffering is because we're kind of frozen, and we find ourselves by way of habit and misunderstanding caught in a little teeny cold cube. And at some point we find ourselves wondering, really? Is that it? It's kind of cold and tight in here. Like, I'm wondering, isn't there? And in fact, there is. There's something more. But the something more is not changing from an ice cube to a, I don't know what, a lizard. The change is one that requires a kind of melting. It's a kind of letting go. There's a kind of softening. So we might imagine that we are going to become someone else or become something else. And actually, what we become is just more ourself. But it's a more alive kind of self. So I told the story on the retreat, which is a story I was told many, many years ago and had forgotten for some time. And it's really the opening lines from a wonderful book by the Nigerian writer Ben Okri called The Famished Road, which was the winner of a Booker Prize. And in the opening lines, Okri writes, in the beginning, there was a river. In the beginning, there was a river. And then the river became a road. And the road spread out to the whole world. But because the river was actually, because the road was actually a river, it was always hungry. And I think this is part of what we can think about as the initiation of our path, that we find ourselves in our little ice cube tray, and we notice there's a hunger, which I would describe as a kind of longing. And we often misplace the longing. We think the longing is for fill in the blank. You all have your favorites, as do I, right? We imagine that a better house, job, partner, sometimes it gets more like chocolate, shoes, car, whatever it is that you think is going to be the thing that makes us happy, that's what we take that internal sense that something's missing, that something's off, and then we cast it outside ourselves, and then we run around trying to get. And, you know, sometimes some of those things that we get are pretty good for a while. Chocolate works sometimes for some people, but it's kind of short-lived, right? Even a new car. I'm in the market for a new car right now, and I remember when I got the car that I have now, how happy I was, and then there was that first, you know, little dent. And, right? So, same kind of process happens whether it's an object or a person or a career or a, right? That we have, there can be some initial contentment from the getting, but it rarely lasts. And so a lot of times, a lot of our suffering is that we just have to keep amping up the volume. We get something and then it didn't last very long. We think, oh, we just need more. You know, more chocolate. Instead of 78%, we want the 98%, you know, cacao chocolate or whatever it is. And so we keep going in this way. But in fact, I think we can begin to understand that that nascent kind of longing is actually a really important seed on the path. It's sometimes described as the spark of what's called bodhicitta. Citta is the word for mind and heart, and bodhi is kind of wisdom or awakening. And so it's that first spark that touches the heart, that first place where we have a sense of either being touched by something external that kind of wakes something up in us, or we see something that gives us a sense of what's possible. Something like that can begin the process of the path. And that longing that touches us, again, we can displace and project it out, or we can begin to understand that really what we're seeking is not so much to be someone else or get somewhere else, but to be here. That's what we want. I sometimes think of it as the difference between moving horizontally and vertically. We actually are seeking a kind of vertical drop into our lives rather than skimming the surface of our lives. And it's very much, you can think about the practice that we do, the meditative practice, as these moments of dropping vertically, where we stop. Literally, we just stop moving. Of course, the mind and heart don't stop, right? But we stop the body, and we sit still, and we allow ourselves to be present with what's here. It's quite actually a radical and courageous act, because the momentum of that forward movement, of that skimming of the surfaces, of that constant looking to get and get away from, is so strong. And so even if you didn't like the content of what was arising during this last period of sitting, say, there's something inherently good in your willingness to just stop and be present with what's here. And so this is a way of understanding this longing as not trying to get somewhere, but as really a kind of return. It's a kind of homecoming. And that as we allow ourselves to drop more and more vertically, that there's a kind of healing that happens, that we start to discover a kind of wholeness that is very difficult to access when we're constantly looking out, grabbing, or pushing away. Right? There's a kind of constant agitation and momentum in our actions of body, speech, and mind. Right? Even when the body stops, as we see, the mind is still going. But can we notice the awareness that's noticing the mind going? Because guess what? It's doing it all the time anyway. Just because we're not noticing doesn't mean it's not happening. So a lot of times we notice and we think, oh, I must be doing this wrong. No, actually it's just right. It's finding a kind of stability, of spaciousness, of kindness to be with that basic agitation that we all hold in our minds, our hearts, our bodies. And as we are increasingly willing to stop and be present with what's here, it's magic, actually. You're not doing anything. You're actually not, you're undoing, right? You're not doing. And in that not doing, something begins to soften and heal and unwind. So I described on the talk on the retreat that for many, many years, I've often said out loud, and I think it's true, that we're walking a wisdom path. Buddhism is often described as a wisdom path. And the wisdom is not so much about information transfer, right, and content. Wisdom is described as this being with things as they are, or seeing or hearing or being present with things as they are. And that the levels of insight we can have about the truth of things as they are, that's the nature of the path of wisdom. It's often, we might also say that the path is the path of being with things as it is, which is the way that Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, used to say it in his broken English. And nobody knew if it was a mistake, you know, grammatical mistake, or if he was actually pointing to something very important. Because in fact, that healing that begins to happen, that wholeness that happens as we drop in, is the healing of that sense of fragmentation and separation that we all feel. That the Buddha described as, in some way, the deepest or most pervasive form of dukkha, of suffering that we experience. So he described, actually I don't know that he ever used this term, but people after looked back at what he said and kind of categorized what he said in these three big clumps. So he described what was called dukkha-dukkha. Dukkha is the word for suffering or dissatisfactoriness or things out of alignment. And he described dukkha-dukkha as being the discomfort of the body. We all know that. Just sit still, or even lie in the most comfortable bed possible for long enough, you too will experience dukkha-dukkha, right? So it's the discomfort of the body. It's also the discomfort of being around people or in situations that we don't want to be around, sort of being stuck in those, and then also being separated from people or situations that we want to be around. So you might just think about your own day-to-day. Anybody have any of those kinds of dukkha? It's kind of really everywhere. It's really basic to being human. And the second kind of category of dukkha that he talked about is, it's really it's called sukha dukkha. It's the nickname for it. Sukha is sweet, and dukkha is suffering or difficulty. So it's the truth that even good moments don't last. It's the truth of impermanence as a kind of suffering, that even when we get everything all lined up just the way we want, doesn't last. We all know that as well, right? And then this third kind of dukkha, which is called sankhara dukkha. Sankhara is our sort of our, it's like the whole fabric of our reactivity, of our habits, of, it's like the structure of the ice cube tray that's keeping us locked in. Right? That's what's described as the sankharas. And the experience of that is often described as the experience of our felt sense of separation. That in because of the way we are wired, there is the experience of a knower and what is known, that we're separate from our experience. And the way this translates for us as human beings is often as a more kind of affective or emotional experience of feeling like we don't belong, we don't fit in, we're different, we're not as good as, we're better than, we're somehow different and separate. You might reflect again if you have ever felt this way. I'm always surprised that almost anyone I talk to has this feeling that somehow they're just not quite like everybody else. Even the people who to you might seem like that's the most kind of middle of the road, normal, popular, however, you know, even those folks feel that way. I found this very surprising. So this is this kind of pervasive, it's sometimes described as a kind of existential dukkha, or felt sense of separation. And it's really at this level that we have the possibility to let our longing allow us to heal that, to come back into a sense of wholeness, of completeness, of connection. To understand things as it is. And it's really this connectivity that I often describe as love, which is not the normal way I'm aware of talking about love. Sometimes in Buddhism we talk about these two wings of the bird that are necessary to fly, to be free. The wing of wisdom, seeing clearly things as they are, or things as it is, and the wing of compassion, of tenderness, of kindness. So it's true that there's an affective feeling that is part of the path. But I think that there's a deeper understanding of what I'm calling love, which is not an emotion so much, but the truth that the fabric of reality itself is a web of interbeing. That the flip side of seeing that there is no separate solid self is seeing that we are infinitely connected. That's actually what it means to be a verb, to be a process, to be a river instead of an ice cube, is to be a part of, to be part of this living web of aliveness, of life itself. So for many, many years, I described that we're on this wisdom path where as we see things more and more clearly as they are, that it leads to a kind of softening and opening of the heart so that we sort of walk this wisdom path and then at the end, we get to this great outpouring of being kinder and more compassionate and so on. And it's actually not a bad description of the path. It's kind of a nice one. But I have had a bit of revision lately that in my own understanding of it. And the revision is really that it's a slight shift, but actually significant, I think, which is that actually the path, the whole of the path, is a path of love. That it begins with this nascent kind of longing that I've been describing, that something in us is touched and pulled on, and that's how we come into the path. Whether it's the heart is pulled on by being inspired by a sense of possibility, or the heart is pulled on often, for so many of us, by difficulty, by seeing suffering in the world, our own, others, the planet's, and that it leads us to feel like, oh, when we really open and let ourselves be touched in that way, there's a natural feeling of wanting to respond, of wanting to find a skillful way to respond. So we could say that it's a wisdom path that ends in a loving heart, but we could also say that it's a path in which there's a kind of nascent love that's touched in us. And then as we walk the path, We mature that love. We deepen and refine it through wisdom. That it's as we see things as they are, more and more and more and more, that our capacity to respond to the world with kindness, with love, with care, gets deeper and deeper. So that it's really about, the Buddha always said, the Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And that in fact, it's love in the beginning, love in the middle, and love in the end. And so for me, it's helped to reorient a bit to what it is that we're up to, and particularly to kind of reclaim this sense of sometimes, you know, the second noble truth, which is the truth of suffering, the third noble truth, which is the truth of the cause of suffering, is described as tanha, or grasping, clinging. And so I think sometimes that gets meshed in a way, or confused with what I'm describing as this kind of longing. It's kind of a wholesome wish for homecoming, for the capacity to help, for this willingness to be touched by the world and by the difficulties that we see in a way that keeps us going on the path. So that we don't have to be afraid of feeling that kind of wishing or longing and think, oh no, no, anything that I want is bad. It's actually not true. We can trust actually very deeply that place in us that's touched, and then trust that that initial thing that's touched will mature over time as we walk the path. It's funny, you know, when you're working with some particular topic, how it just shows up everywhere. So, like I said, I'm in the process of looking to buy a new car, and so of course, what do I see on the road? Everywhere, you know, there's the car I want. There's, you know, I'm seeing cars in a way that I normally wouldn't. So yesterday I was reading the paper, and sure enough, there was this article that spoke right to this topic that I've been describing. This is from the New York Times, an article by the writer, the commentary writer David Brooks, and it's called The Art of Focus. And it's really about his description of, you know, you all have heard all of the data probably about how distracted we are and how useful it is to learn how to focus our attention. And I love what he says here that points to this reclaiming, in a way, of this kind of nascent longing, this kind of love that I'm pointing to that I think we can trust. He says, the lesson from childhood, so he's referring to a study that somebody else did. He says, the lesson from childhood is that if you want to win the war for attention, meaning focus, don't try to say no to the trivial distractions you find on the information smorgasbord. So just to give context. So he's saying, if you want to be more focused, if you want to have better attention, the strategy is not to try to shut things out. You know, and say, I'm not going to answer my cell phone, or I'm not going to this, or I'm not going to that. No, 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 no. And the onslaught of all the information coming in, which seems to me would be a kind of normal strategy, right? And it's not to say that that is a bad thing to do, but he's pointing in a different direction. So the lesson is that if you want to win the war for attention, I hadn't noticed the win the war part, but okay, we might change that language. If you want to get better at focus, don't try to say no to the trivial distractions you find on the information smorgasbord. Instead, try to say yes to the subject that arouses a terrifying longing, and let the terrifying longing crowd out everything else. It's beautiful. So he's saying, don't just run around going, no, 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 and try to deprive yourself. Instead, in my language, I would say, listen deeply to what it is that calls you. What is it that touches you? What is that longing? What is that wish that we're often too afraid to even open to? And there's many good reasons to be afraid. Many of us have had longings be laughed at or shut down or disappointed, but his encouragement is to open to that. It's a wonderful instruction. He goes on to say, the way to discover a terrifying longing is to liberate yourself from the self-censoring labels you began to tell yourself over the course of your miseducation. And then he goes on to say, you can only recover your appetite, your longing, if you can allow yourself to be unknown to yourself. You can only recover your appetite if you can allow yourself to be unknown to yourself. It's beautiful. And really, this is very much at the heart of this teaching of non-self or anatta. It's not that we're trying to get rid of the self. It's that we're trying to discover ourselves anew. We're trying to learn how to be unknown to ourselves so that we can actually listen in to something that we may not have heard before. That we can listen past our habits and reactivity to find, you know, that warm water at the center of the ice cube. That we can allow ourselves to melt enough that we can hear something that is inherently good and trustworthy, and that we can then follow that and trust that as we practice, that kind of spark, as it's described as bodhicitta, or that seed that's planted, will grow in each of us. So again, there's this consistent kind of reorientation from thinking of wanting as a bad thing to understanding that our longing has beauty in it, but that we have to listen, you know? And that the understanding of non-self is not about getting rid of ourselves or, as he describes, trying to shut things out, but actually being willing to listen in a very deep way to what's true for us, to listen and be courageous to feel what matters, what touches us, what moves us, and to allow that to be kind of guide our lives. For many, many years, I've talked about and actually taught this wisdom training of mindfulness, of paying attention in a more secular setting, simply as listening. That we can, that listening is a quality of attention that we can bring to our lives. So I don't mean hearing. Right? Everybody can hear the cars outside. The hearing happens spontaneously. The listening is something else. And there's a, if you look at the Chinese character for listening, it's actually made up of a bunch of component parts, which are include ear as part of the character, but also include eye, and include heart, and includes you, and includes undivided attention. So these are all of what go into listening. And in the Mahayana tradition, there is this beautiful figure of bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is an awakening being, or a being dedicated to the awakening of all beings, oneself and others. And this particular bodhisattva is the bodhisattva of compassion. And the name Avalokiteshvara is translated often as one who hears the cries of the world. One who hears the cries of the world. So that the compassionate response of the heart comes from this willingness to listen, to be touched. And the iconography, some of you may have seen in the images of this Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara, often has a whole halo of arms and hands spread out in this way. And at the end of each arm is a hand, and inside each hand is an eye, which I always thought was kind of odd, because it's, again, this translation is one who hears, but it's shown with an eye, which is kind of demonstrating, I think, that hearing is not just with the ears. That hearing is something that we do with our eyes, with our ears, with our arms, with our heart, with our whole self. And this archetypal figure of Avalokiteshvara, this bodhisattva of compassion, is shows up in all the different Buddhist traditions in different ways. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's actually usually a she who shows up as a Tara. And in Chinese, the tradition of Buddhism, Avalokiteshvara shows up as Kuan Yin, also a she. And Avalokiteshvara is often a kind of androgynous figure, sort of neither male nor female necessarily. So when I was a young Zen student, I used to do this chant called the Heart Sutra every day in the Zen monasteries all over the world. We do this chant, one day in English, one day in Japanese. That's how we did it. And the chant begins like this: Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing, basically saw into the truth of non-self, saw that all five skandhas, which is a system that I talked about the last few weeks of describing a moment of self, a moment of experience. So Avalokiteshvara saw that all five skandhas were empty. So not only was the self empty, but the like building blocks of the self, those are empty too. Kind of pulls the rug out from under you a bit. And in that seeing, relieved all suffering. So it's the wisdom deepened the compassion, right? So all these years I would chant this every morning, and I did a lot of wanting to understand what the skandhas were and what it was that Avalokiteshvara was waking up to and so on. And then I had this insight one day where I realized, it's the structure of the way this story is told is telling me something that I had missed, that was right in front of my face, which is that it's compassion. It's this figure of this heart figure of Avalokiteshvara that wakes up. It's love that wakes up. It's not about the waking up, it's about the love waking up. Right? I had missed that after years, every day chanting the same thing. Right? This is often what it's like when we have our understanding reveals to us something about our heart, about the real depth of the practice. So it's, again, it sort of circles back on this. Avalokiteshvara is the one who hears, the one who listens to the cries. And it's that nascent heart, that hearing, that willingness to be touched, that's what wakes up. That's what is matured. And when that is matured, we are increasingly able to respond in more and more skillful ways to ourselves, to others, to the various difficulties that we encounter in the world. So maybe I have a few other things that I could read or say, but I think worth taking a little pause to see if you have thoughts, reflections, questions, anything you'd like to, or just something that is touched as you hear. Please, if you say your name and then.
Sure, it's mine.
Yeah.
I had a question when you were talking about the three types of suffering. I understood that dukkha is like a sense, one of the elements is like a sense of isolation from others. And then with the sankhara dukkha, it was separation from experience, kind of not
Sankhara dukkha is the felt sense of separation. The first kind of dukkha, dukkha, is the dukkha of physical discomfort, the dukkha of being separated from those things and people we love, and this dukkha of being with people in situations we don't love. That's kind of like the garden variety dukkha.
So it's like you're out of town. It's parallel to that. You're physically distant with the dukkha, and you're saying with the sankhara dukkha, you're emotionally distant.
No, just think of all the distant part is under sankhara dukkha. And the dukkha is not about the separation. It's more basic than that. It's more just ouch. You know, the basic feeling of, you know, ouch, my hip hurts or my head hurts, or I'm irritated by that person who I have to sit next to at work, or I don't get to be with the person who, you know, or that situation that I want to be around. It's basically just pleasant and unpleasant experience at its most basic level.
You mean more visceral.
Yeah.
Like I'm feeling a stomach upset. Maybe I'm isolated from somebody. Got it.
Or I'm just feeling a stomach upset. Like any kind of physical discomfort is just dukkha, garden variety dukkha. And then when you're stuck in a room with somebody you don't like, that's dukkha. And when you are wishing that you could be with some person who you aren't with, that's also dukkha. The separation in sankhara dukkha is a little different. It's not just about physical distance, as you said. It's more like feeling I don't belong, I'm not a part of, I don't fit in, but more like that. That's more how we experience it. Yeah. Please.
What are the five skandhas?
Does anybody remember? Five skandhas was her question.
No.
Feeling. That's number two.
Form.
Yeah.
Cognition,
yeah. So I'll give you the first and one and five first, because I think that's the easiest way. So the question was, what are the five skandhas? So the first is what's called form, and it basically means both our physical form and also external forms. So stuff, form. And then the fifth skanda is what's called vijnana, which is consciousness. And the way that a basic moment of experience happens is that the sense organs, which in Buddhism we have six sense organs, so the eye organ, which is the form called the eye, comes in contact with that black cushion, which is the external form, and in that moment of contact, seeing consciousness arises. So form and consciousness arise together in a moment of contact. When that contact happens, the other three skandhas happen boom, 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 very fast. And they are, in a moment of contact, we have the experience of it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, meaning we like it or we don't like it or we don't notice. So every moment of experience has what's called a vedana, a feeling tone. And it's usually actually under our level of consciousness. We don't really notice that we don't like something until we're pretty far along in the process of strategizing how to get away from it, for example. We don't usually notice that moment of just unpleasant, but that can be a really useful practice. So form and consciousness, rupa skanda and vijnana skanda, come together. And in that moment, there's a vedana, there's a feeling tone. And then there are two other things that happen very quickly. One is that there is the best word is recognition. There's a naming, basically. I see something, it's just a black form, and my mind, recognition is useful because basically, very, very quickly, my mind or your mind goes through all past experiences I've ever had with a round black object and tries to fit this into that category, right? Sometimes it's called perception or recognition. So, and it goes, oh, cushion. Right? I think that one of the best ways for recognizing this, how this happens, is when we miscognize. I had this experience actually while I was on the retreat last week, where I was walking up a path behind the retreat center, and I saw, it was just like they write about in the scriptures, you know, I saw a stick and I thought it was a snake. I went like that. It was actually a piece of curled bark that looked kind of the shape of a snake. And there it was. So that's perception or recognition, but usually we don't notice that we're naming everything, but sometimes when we get it wrong, we may go, oh, I just did that, right? If we catch it. And then the fourth skanda, is basically all of the reactivity, all of the story making that piles on top of that. So any association that I have with a stick or a snake or a black cushion will be, yes, this, and it reminds me of that, and it's all of that story making that goes. And all of that happens really fast. So this was a way in the early Buddhist teaching that there was a way to describe there's no separate solid thing called me. All there are these moments of experience that are arising that include these five parts. Does that make sense?
It will.
Yeah, yeah. It's very complex and technical, actually, which is part of why I wanted to give like a heart talk tonight, right? Because I've been doing this kind of intense technical describing how moment of experience happens. What's interesting is in the Heart Sutra, they're saying not only is there these five things that happen and therefore we have no solid self, but even those five things are empty. Meaning each of those is conditioned on everything else. They don't actually exist. There's no atomic chart that we can fall back on. It's kind of the same in science, right? The closer and closer you look at the atoms and then the nucleus and then the electrons, the more and more you see, whoa, mostly just space. Kind of like that. Same in the process of trying to find out who we are. The closer and closer we look, and the more and more every system we come up with to describe it doesn't hold water, as it were. Because the whole thing's water, right? It's not even water, it's a river. The point is not the water, the point is the movement, the flow, the aliveness. So our minds are always wanting to like go H2O. But the practice is one that just says, you know, in a way, get in the river. Really, I often say the practice is about be the river. That's what we get the opportunity to do instead of going, I am, and we all have our list of things, and it's fine in the conventional reality to be whoever you are. To have your name and your job and your roles and your, you know, so I have a teacher who always says, at the end of the night, please don't take somebody else's shoes when you go out the door, right? It's okay. In conventional reality, you'd be like, no, these are my shoes and those are your shoes, and don't take somebody else's shoes. It'll just, but in the microscope that we're looking under to discover who we really are, at a conventional level, we're all separate and we have our own shoes. But when we start to look really, really closely, those edges start to break down, right? The ice cubes start to melt. And we start to become aware of this fabric of living water that we are all creating, co-creating moment by moment together. And it can be terrifying to the little self, you know, it's like the terrifying longing that David Brooks talks about, because that's, we're already tapping into that. And it also is totally liberating and beautiful and alive, right? Because it's kind of, I always say, it can be kind of feel safe when we're in our little ice cube tray. But the longer you stay in your ice cube tray, the more there's going to be this longing that keeps going, hello, hello. And then at some point, we listen. and then we come to a meditation group on a Wednesday night, or we go on a retreat, or we start reading books, or because something in us knows, wait, cannot be just ice cube tray world. I know there's more than that, and you are right. So congratulations for showing up. Please.
Separation, the sense of separation. It's something that's to kind of, I see like kind of intellect, and certainly see intellect that it's caused by grasping, that it's caused by wholly fixating on something, and then you get this sense of separation. But moving to the sense of the whole, away from the sense of separation, I guess it's just, you just look at it, you just pay attention to it, and you just sit with it, you know, you sit until it little by little moves on its own.
I would say a little bit differently. So the sense of separation is actually prior to the grasping. The grasping is a result of the sense of separation. Grasping, or what I described earlier as tanha, grasping actually means grasping after what's pleasant and pushing away what's unpleasant. So it's both grasping and aversion. They're the same movement, just depending on whether the experience is pleasant or unpleasant. So that constant reactivity, grasping and pushing away, grasping and pushing away, is a result of our felt sense of separation. If we didn't feel separate, we wouldn't need to grab and push away, would we?
It seems like separation is both, the fear is both the cause and a result of separation. You know, it seems like it's in a sense.
So the way that we're wired, so this is, I want to say this in a way that you understand that it's not your fault. Right? Really, the sense of separation is not your fault. It's how we're wired. In order to know anything, there has to be an object to be known. And as soon as there's an object to be known, there's a subject knowing. That's separation. That's what I mean. This is not because you're doing something wrong. It's just that it's how perception works. Subject, object, subject, object. So it's part of why the kind of meditation that we've been trying to point to a bit is, instead of looking at the subject or the object, look at the awareness itself. The awareness is, if I'm the subject, Pam, and there's that black cushion, that's the object, can I be aware of the seeing? Because the seeing has some of that fluidity in it, right? It's the thing that connects. The awareness is the fabric that connects, which I also earlier described as love. That connectivity is actually the truth of something quite beautiful. But the seeing something separate is not your fault. It's not because you're doing something wrong. So rather than walking around and trying to see things as merged or one or unified, see the separation. You don't have to play tricks. You want to see, oh, look at that. That's what I see. And then feel how you feel separate. And if you pay close attention to that felt sense of separation, you will feel that kind of, it's again, it's the third kind of dukkha, this sankhara dukkha. It's very subtle and totally pervasive, meaning it's in every moment, because there's always subject, object, subject, object, except when it falls away for a moment. And then we're like, whoa, what was that? Everybody's had those experiences where you just merge with your experience. And all kinds of different ways to have access to those experiences. But one of the most important components of it is the harder you try, the worse it gets. So really, it's why a lot of the meditative instruction is about, like, relax. Right? Because how do you get the ice cube out of its tray? It melts. It has to soften. That's right. That's how you do it. Yeah, unless you want to like go around whacking. So that the practice is not, we're not encouraging the whack practice. Encourage the soften, relax, seeing how everything's happening. It's because we think, no, I did that. So the same with seeing an object. Don't try to not see the object. No, see the objects and see how you think you're doing it all, and see how tight that makes you. You know, how frozen you get in your ice cube. You want to feel that suffering. Because if you don't feel it, you'll just think, well, I just need to move over to a different ice cube tray. It'll be better over there. Nicer view, a little bit bigger, maybe nicer color, whatever it is. That's what we fool ourselves into thinking, oh, I just need to... No, it's actually a radical shift that happens. Is that a hand over here?
You can see my mouth open. Start talking. It's like, why don't I say something kind of unpleasant?
So you only have a few minutes. So,
okay,
so
well,
good thing.
So we'll go dark here for a minute. So, like what you just said, it seems to me the first thing that you said, because we're talking about cars and chocolate and things like that, and I was like, this is the thing about Buddhism that kind of drives me a little bit crazy. It's like, what about evil? What about just like really bad, something like bad?
Yeah.
Evil.
Yeah.
Evil, evil, evil. What about you're a normal person and there's evil? I mean, and it's done its bad thing.
So
you just like let be the river?
You don't be the river. So I think that the question is about, you know, what about evil? I think it's a really important question. And from my perspective, I think Buddhism actually describes and understands the core, the seed of that evil before it gets all spun out into evil. So the core of that evil is that we actually believe that if we can just control things, if we can just get what we want and get away from what we don't want, everything will be fine. And we actually believe that to
that
the point that escalates toward evil. So if I am someone who believes that and I happen to have a lot of power in a big army and I think that those people are the problem, I'm going to get rid of them.
And you have no compassion. I mean, evil people generally don't really have much empathy for anybody. But
the point is that it is based on a fundamental misunderstanding. That's why it's so helpful to practice before we get there. To practice and to feel that, like, I really think that if I have that piece of chocolate, I'm going to be happy. It's not that different from someone who's allowed this to escalate and is in a different set of circumstances who, instead of chocolate, feels like, if I can just get, you know, a bigger palace and annex a few more countries and knock out a few more people, then I'm going to be happy. Right? So you don't have the, I don't think, I don't know you very well, but you don't have the power to do that. But if you had that mind and heart, that confusion in your mind and heart, and you happen to be in a situation where you could be, you know.
Well, what if you're the recipient of somebody? What if you're on the receiving end of that?
Then you are suffering quite a lot. Actually, both sides are suffering quite a lot. So is the question, do you just roll over?
There's many questions. There just never seems to be really discussed to me.
Uh-huh.
I never feel that it's ever really discussed.
Okay, well, we're trying to discuss it now, but unfortunately we only have a few minutes.
I understand.
But I actually think it's right at the center of everything we're talking about, right? So when the Buddha said, I'm interested in suffering and the end of suffering, that's what he's talking about. He wasn't talking about, I want to stop eating chocolate. He was talking about, there is a lot of heavy shit going down in the world, and I want to understand what the cause of that is so that I can be free, and I can teach other people to be free themselves. It's the whole point. Period, end of story. Now, are we successful? We have a long way to go, don't we? Yeah, we do. But it's for each of us to decide, you know, which side do we want to be on? Do you want to be on the side that's running around being driven by your habits? Or do you want to be on the side that's making your best effort, right, to wake up, to see things as they are, to allow yourself to be moved through the world, through your path, through your life, based on understanding the truth of our connection and love, Or do you want to be run around in your life based on fear, based on trying to get and get away from? Which again is, I think if we look, if you look at any of the horrible things that you see in the newspaper every day, you can drive, you can go right to that and say, how did that happen? And see a confused person who's trying to get or get away from, fill in the blank. This is just the escalation of the very thing we're talking about here. This is not a small project we're up to. And it's not just about sitting and calming down and being quiet and finding a moment of peace. That's nice. But we're actually looking to, as I described earlier, we're looking to mature our love with wisdom so that we don't become agents of destruction in the world, that we are doing our best to wake up so that we can be helpful instead of harmful. And it is humbling, yes? So instead of feeling like I'm failing, what's wrong with me, we can, as the Buddha did in his own path, you know, reach down and touch the earth, because this is so hard. And that if we understand that in ourselves, we will not be so judgmental of the bad stuff that other people are doing. Because, I mean, come on. You can get up with like the best intention in the world, and all somebody has to do is look at you sideways and boom. If it's, you know, you've got the wrong amount of coffee in your system or hormones or whatever your deal is, whoosh, off you go. So this is a kind of softening and compassion that we bring to ourselves and to other people, because this is hard work. This is not a magic pill. But it's worthwhile. Because of all the suffering in the world, because of all the evil, because there's so much dukkha, the Buddha said, right? So it's not, this is not meant to be abstract. It's actually quite practical. I'll say one more thing and then I have to let you go because it's time.
Once more, that if evil is close to home, if that suffering is close to home, you may have to walk away from it to be in a place where you can,
yes,
find that peace.
Yes.
It's not all in different countries.
No, that's the whole point. It's in us. That's why we're paying attention here. That's why we're wanting to notice that we're constantly grabbing and pushing away so that we're not going to be so judgmental of somebody else who's doing the same. That's right. It's a shared human predicament. We are them, right? So let's sit for a moment or two just to close out the evening. So just taking a moment to notice what's here in you, the impact of the words, the conversation, the dialogue this evening. And whether you feel agitated or calm, sad, frustrated, or peaceful. Just letting what's here be here. Receiving it with kindness. And as we bring our evening to a close, offering all of the goodness gathered here in us, between us, around us, offering all of that out into the world in ever widening circles. Touching the lives of all beings everywhere. May all beings be happy and peaceful. May all beings everywhere be safe and free from harm. And may we, together with all beings, awaken to the truth and beauty of who and what we really are.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.